WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You had a pretty traditional, top-notch type of training. You went to Juilliard and you studied in Paris with Nadia Boulanger.
Yeah, that's right.
When did you decide to leave that kind of formal classical music?
That kind of tradition. It wasn't really so much a decision. It was something that really happened in the course of what I was doing. By the time I finished at Juilliard, I was around 25 or so, and I went to study with Boulanger. I stayed with her until I was about 27 or 28. So I had done. I began studying music when I was 8. So I had really done about 20 years of music school, and I think a lot of what happened at that point was, first of all, feeling I had I needed to get away from that kind of background, which had become just a little bit overwhelming at that point, because I had done so much of it and had worked a lot in that way too. At that point, I had written over 70 pieces anyway.
What kind of music were you writing?
Well, I wrote the music. The music that sounded like my teachers. I studied with Vincent Persichetti, who's from Philadelphia, of course. And at the time, he helped me get some of my early pieces published at that time. But I think that the music I was doing wasn't. I mean, I think I was like an A-plus student, or maybe an A-minus student or something. But anyway, I was a good student, and it sounded like that. I mean, it wasn't very distinctive. I don't think that music is really worth thinking about, for me, at any rate. What happened when I left New York and went to Paris is that I found myself in a musical environment that was really dominated by Boulez and the Domaine Musicale concerts at that time, where the major showcase for new music in Paris. That meant what you heard was almost entirely serial music. The only Americans that were done there, by the way, were a little Morty Feldman's music and Earl Brown. For some reason, they had been accepted by that group of composers. So, and I didn't particularly like that kind of music. In fact, I actively didn't like it. My music had gotten to the point where I had experimented a little bit with serial music myself, but it hadn't really stuck with me. It wasn't really, I never felt it was my voice or there was anything personal in it for me. But it was about this time, and I'm talking about 1964, 65, when I began traveling first in North Africa, because it was a cheap place to go in the summertime. And then a little bit later on, I traveled through Central Asia, straight through to India. And I got to hear a lot of different music then. And I happened to, I was lucky enough to work with Ravi Shankar in Paris, and I think it was 65. He was hired to do a film score, and I was hired to do the notation for it. So I spent a fair amount of time with him during that period. And he really introduced me to a lot of musical ideas which aren't part of a Western tradition, but part of the tradition of classical Indian music. And I began to see that there were really other ways of approaching music. But I wasn't alone in this. It was a period, we're talking about the middle to late 60s now, where people were becoming very aware of culture as being a world phenomenon, not just a Western phenomenon. And though we studied very little of that at Juilliard, there were records in the library, but that wasn't part of our study, to study Indian music or African music or Japanese music, perhaps in some kind of historical way. But to take those great traditions of music in terms of a body of technical ideas or aesthetic ideas, we didn't do that at all. So that at that point, by the way, this is just before the Beatles discovered Indian music, so that we didn't even have that kind of big kind of...
You didn't hear shoe store commercials with sitars on
it? No, it wasn't. It was just a little before that, about 3 years before that. So that it really wasn't generally well known. When Ravi Shankar came to the West, he played for rather small groups of people. So anyway, that was how I first became in contact with this larger tradition of world musics. And it was from that became actually a real source of inspiration for me.
Were there specific rhythmic or harmonic things especially?
Yeah, I was mostly interested in the rhythmic structure of the music. And for that reason, I began to study with Alaraka, who was the tabla player that's associated with Ravi Shankar. And I actually studied with him for, well, I don't know for how long, maybe through one winter anyway. They were back in New York. They were in New York City. I think Ravi was teaching at NYC, at New York University. New York University. No, not New York University. I think the City College of New York, actually. And he was teaching there, and Alaraka was there. So I began studying with Alaraka.
Was there like a moment where you felt like you were starting to find your voice and starting to compose?
Well, that was very definite. And that was when I was still in Paris. I was also working with a group that later became, evolved into a theater group called the Mabu Minds. They were just in Philadelphia last week. I hear that was an event for the people that saw it. Anyway, one of the directors of that theater was a woman I was married to for, was my first wife. So, and I still am associated with the theater. I still do music with them. So that one of the first new pieces I did, I was asked to do music for a play that they were doing in Paris, a play by Samuel Beckett. And I began to work in a very different way than I had been working before, one that was characterized by an emphasis on rhythmic profile that had very little exploration of pitch relationship or harmony or things like that. It was a very reductive music. It was very reduced music. It's that period of the music that myself and some other people got labeled minimalist. It's really that period, really, that refers to. It's not really appropriate for the music that happened later. But the music I was doing from 1965 to about 1974, all of that music was very reductive. It has very simple pitch relationships. Sometimes the whole piece will be just on one set of pitches or one chord. It has a steady eighth note beat all the way through it. And another thing is that my music's amplified, so it tends to be, in those days it was considered very loud, and now it's not considered that loud anymore.
I'm sorry.
I think people have just gotten used to that part of it.
Do you think of there being a theory?
Well, I didn't myself organize any ideas in that way. Other people have done that. For me also, the music's been evolving to, not exactly rapidly, but rather too steadily for me to stop and do that. And it's also for that reason that I never really taught. I kind of didn't want to. I didn't want to make a final definition of what the music was involved with. I felt that would, I would then be working within this definition that I had created. So I haven't really stopped to do that. And the pieces continue to change. The new work is very different from pieces I did 10 years ago or even 3 or 4 years ago. I kind of have a horror of self-definition. I'm afraid that somehow that the whole process would become arrested in a way.
Let's take a pause here and listen to some of the music that we're discussing. Philip Glass is my guest. Why don't we listen to a couple of minutes from one of the sections of Music for Changing Parts?
Okay, that's a piece from 1970. And that would be the early days of the ensemble. And let me just say something about the ensemble. The ensemble that I started in 68 is for two electric keyboards, three or four winds, and a voice. And that became the standard ensemble that I used up until the present. I'm still working with that group. We were in Philadelphia last year. I think you reminded me we were here on February 14th last year. But as a performing group, the sound of the group is very much the same still. The music changes very differently, however.
Can you say a little bit about what's happening in Music for Changing Parts?
This piece, I think the part that we're going to listen to, it's built on what I at that time called an additive process, where there was a simple rhythmic idea that would be repeated for kind of indefinite number of times, and then we'd go on to the next section. And each of the sections, each of the what I called figures, were related to each other by the addition or subtraction of one of the beats, so that you would have a 5/8 figure going to a 6/8 to a 7/8 to a 9/8, so that each figure has a highly different kind of rhythmic feeling to it. And with that, this was the only piece that I did in which I allowed some improvisation. The players played long notes, some of them do, for the length of a breath, that was the rule. And they were supposed to be related to the kind of difference tones, overtones, what we called psychoacoustical phenomena that happens with loud music and with strong rhythmic music. And those, I think the part we're going to listen to will have some of that improvised music with it.
Let's hear a short selection from this, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
From the album Music with Changing Parts by Philip Glass, and Philip Glass is my guest. I guess it was about the time of this recording that people started referring to music as trance music or
minimal
music.
Yeah, I never liked that very much.
Yeah, what do you think of those two terms?
Well, trance music I never liked as a description. For one thing, I think it's, I think it's somewhat, to me it's always seen a pejorative description, as if you put on the music and go to sleep. Though, in fact, people sleep through a lot of music, sleep through Beethoven or Mahler, too. So I guess in that way I could say that I'm in pretty good company. But I always thought that music required a kind of attentiveness rather than a kind of unattention. But at any rate, in terms of minimal, I think the word, of course, as you know, it's a creation of, as a word, it's coined by journalists. It's a way of describing in a kind of shorthand way something. For listeners, and it's difficult. It is difficult to describe a kind of music that, when it first emerged, was very new. The difficulty with the word now is that it doesn't prepare you for what you're going to hear. Now, I would say this, that in many ways, the music still tends to be much more reduced than a lot of other kinds of new music. One of the things that's happened in the last 15 years is that we have a much bigger variety of acceptable experimental music than we did, say, in 65, 66. So, and in a general way, it differentiates this music from some other kinds of music. The difficulty is if you tell someone that they're about to hear minimal music, and then you hit them with an opera that has a chorus and six soloists and an orchestra with six-part counterpoint and canons and all kinds of stuff running around in it, then they can fairly ask, well, what does this have to do with minimalism? And in fact, the music, that description, I think applies fairly to pieces that were done, like the one we just heard. And I would say up to 1974. But by the time we get past Einstein on the Beach in terms of my own work, I think it's just doesn't really prepare you for what's going to happen.
Well, let's hear the kind of an example of the kind of piece you're talking about, which is very rich and dense and I think passionate as well. I think you'd be hard pressed to call it minimal. We're going to hear the opening of Dance Number 3. Can you talk a little bit about musically what's happening in this?
Well, first of all, Dance was written for Lucinda Childs. It was an evening length dance piece. Saul LeWitt, the artist, did a film that went with it. So it was a kind of a what we used to in the old days call a mixed media event, but now we call it. What's it called now? Some kind of performance.
Performance event.
Yeah. But at any rate, what I had done at this point, by 74, I had begun to introduce ideas of cyclic harmonic ideas into the music. And it, in fact, it works in a very similar way. In Dance 3, which we're about to hear, there's a chord progression which is additive in the way that the rhythmic progressions were additive. That if you were to listen to the whole side, you would hear a progression that started from one or two chords to three or four, five, six, seven, eight, until there's a whole string of chord changes in the piece. In that way, it's related structurally to that kind of additive thinking that I did.
Okay, well, let's listen to the opening of Dance Number 3, composed by Philip Glass and performed by the Philip Glass Ensemble. From the album Dances, that was the opening of Dance Number 3, composed by my guest Philip Glass and performed by the Philip Glass Ensemble. I think you probably had to evolve a different style of performance in order to get players who could play that kind of complex timing.
I was lucky in that way that I've had, the ensemble's been together, I guess about 15 years now. And many of the players are the same players that I began with. So I've had I've been lucky to have a lot of the same players over a long period of time, and a lot of these changes are more gradual than we're able to hear in this program. So that we did develop performance techniques for this music, and they evolved gradually. So that through another fortunate thing is that we perform a lot. So that if we do maybe 30, 40 performances a year. That means that we have a lot of time to spend working out the performance problems of this kind of music. Also, we record. All the recordings are done with this, basically this ensemble or an expansion of it. The recording engineer, the sound engineer for the performances is also the record producer of the records, Kurt Mankese, so that we can move into the recording studio with pretty much the same people. Usually after we've played a piece for quite a few times.
In standard music, players can be counting to themselves or watching a conductor whose arms are probably making movements that conform to the beat. But the rhythms on your music are so complex, I wonder almost how people know where they are and can keep their place in the music. And it's so precise that you can't afford to have a player straying.
It's a chamber music in that way, where you can have a kind of more intricate rhythmic music than you could have in a large orchestra piece. The difference between this piece and an opera like Satyagraha is very different in that with an opera like that, where you don't have so much rehearsal time, and you have a conductor, in the case of when it was done in America, it was Christopher Keene. All the music had to be notated in a very standard notation for players. So it was interesting translating the kind of problems that we had in the ensemble into a larger ensemble with people that weren't familiar with the music in the way that we were. In the end, Christopher told me that Satyagraha was no more difficult to perform than Tosca. That's what he said. It wasn't really that hard. But I should say this, that we have to remember that this music has been around now for a good 15 years. And that might not have been true 10 years ago. So that there's it's established its own norm in a way. It's no longer radical as it had seemed at the time. And a lot of people, when we're in a recording studio now and we bring in string players, like in the photographer or other players who aren't really with the ensemble, very often the studio musicians are people that know the music. Heard it and they're familiar with it, and it's not going to be a big surprise for them.
How do you know where you are when you're playing? What are you, well, are you thinking?
We're reading. All the music's notated. It has to be. One of the things that's still true is that, as in changing parts of the first piece we heard, I said that the music was divided into figures that are really more like large measures in a way. And the music is still organized more or less in that way. What I've done is that in the early pieces, the length of the figures were improvised by myself, and I nodded my head, and that usually meant to play the figure twice and move on to the next figure. The trouble is, if someone misses the nod, then they're in the wrong place, and that can happen from time to time. After that, over the years, I gradually formalized that so that I've written, indicated next to the figure how many times it's to be repeated, if it's three times or four times. And so we are usually all together. I mean, we're all reading music together, and if someone gets out of place, we can hear right away that they are, and they have to, we have ways of their finding their way back into the music. Usually we follow the bass line, and either I will indicate the figure, and then Michael Reisman, who's the other keyboard player, might indicate the beats with his head. And we have developed ways of helping lost players to find their way back to music. It happens not so much anymore. I mean, we've been playing an awful lot. Funny things can happen, though. For example, someone will turn two pages of music instead of one, and suddenly they're in the wrong place. I mean, that kind of thing can happen to anybody. That can happen with Bartok. It doesn't necessarily happen to me alone. But some of the performance problems really have to do not so much with with keeping our place. That we can do with a fair amount of ease. Another thing that's happening in the music is usually there are two or three basic rhythmic beats going on at the same time. And integrating those together can take a lot of rehearsal. In the piece that we just heard, a dance, some of the players are playing in basically 3/4, and another player is playing 6/8 against that. And I mean, obviously that fits in a fairly easy way, but keeping the rhythmic feeling of the 6/8 distinct from the 3/4 becomes the kind of thing that we work on.
Do you enjoy performing?
Yeah, I do. I do enjoy performing, but the trouble with performing is the touring that we do now. For example, we're going on a tour in April. Is that if you go on a 3-week tour, we say we do 15 concerts. We're actually only playing for 30 hours in the 3 weeks, and there's a lot of time in between that you're not really doing anything terribly interesting, just traveling from one place to the other. The playing part has always been part that I feel very at home with and very comfortable with.
Do the players in your group ever feel that their playing is submerged in the ensemble?
Well, it's supposed to be. This is chamber music, really. There aren't really solo parts in it. Now, that's not so true in some of the newer pieces. The Photographer, which is this new record that we have, there's the second act is for solo violin and an ensemble. I mean, clearly there's a solo part in that. But one of the aims of the ensemble was to really create an ensemble sound. So it requires the kind of intimate playing that you hear in a string quartet or a piano quintet or something like that. And unfortunately, fortunately, the musicians I work with address themselves to this problem and will listen. There's a lot of playing has to do with listening. With listening to where you are, listening to the subtleties of the rhythmic phrasing and integrating the parts together.
Do you think of your music as being intellectual, emotional, sensual?
Well, the intellectual part is, of course, there's a part of that that has to do largely with the writing. But by the time we get to playing, one of the things that we aim for as performers is putting over a piece with a kind of emotional impact. For me, music is very emotional. Now, the curious thing about music of this kind is that is highly organized, but that's really the composer's job, and it's not really I don't think the audience has to really know that. Professional musicians often like to look at the scores to see how the music's put together, and even people who are real music lovers would like to get to know the music better. But understanding the mechanics of the music is one thing, and understanding the music in a direct emotional way, I don't think for most people it's really necessary. Certainly, it enriches the way you hear it if you take a multi-level approach to it, but it's certainly not a requirement.
Is that why you don't publish your scores?
Well, I did that for a different reason. I started out as with the performing ensemble in '68, and it seemed to me that the way to guarantee or the way to facilitate our being able to get performances would be if we were the only ones to perform the music. So that if, for example, someone in Houston wanted to play my music, they had to hire me to come down and play it. So it began really as economic reasons. At this point, that's not really completely true with the operas now, though I've become the publisher of the music, and the music is on rental to opera companies that want to do it. So it's available in that way. People that really want to look at the music, actually, what they have to do is to call me up and find if they can manage to do that, and they come and look at it, or I lend it to them, or this and that. At the moment, to tell you the truth, I really haven't had the time to pursue. The reasons are not so much economic anymore for the reason that it's not published. At this point, the reason it's not published is I really haven't had the time to sit down and get that part of my life organized properly.
Although people don't have access to your scores and can't,
no, they don't.
Can't play your music, people are being influenced by it.
Well, it's on the radio a lot, like this.
Yeah.
Music in print form is not, I mean, it used to be, of course, that was the only way we got music, and it's not so terribly important for the general music audience anymore. We have, not only do we have my own concertizing, but one of the main things for getting this music better known has been radio. And it's on the radio more and more now, so that it's not, I can go to a town that I haven't played in before and I'll have a big audience there, and there'll be people that have never heard the music live, but they've been hearing the music for years.
For new wave bands or classical musicians who are obviously being influenced by your work and are borrowing ideas from it, do you feel like flattered or ripped off by that?
Well, I never really felt ripped off, because when the band that this is mostly the it began really with the German bands in the 70s began doing that, people like Kraftwerk and Tangerine Dream and so forth. But my feeling about it was that we played a lot in Europe in the early days, and we played in Berlin and Paris and London and the people, I've gotten to know these people since then, and they tell me that we made a very big impression on the young pop musicians at that time. It seemed to me that they were doing something that I wouldn't have done anyway, that they were taking the music and turning it into something that was maybe more generally accessible than my music was at that point. And I always thought that it helped to create a wider audience for the music. I thought it was actually a good thing. For one thing, I wasn't interested in running pop tunes using these kinds of ideas, but the more this became part of a general musical language, the less bizarre and strange my music seems, so that in a way, groups like Tangerine Dream and Kraftwerk helped create a kind of a climate for many people later on to hear my music, and though they didn't know that that had been the origins of it, they came to my music with a kind of familiarity which they weren't even aware of where it had come from in a certain way. So I think that it actually was very helpful at a certain point. That was mostly in the 70s. Now, my feeling about it is when I hear young composers imitating my music, that's not the music that interests me. The music by younger composers that interests me is a music that really doesn't sound that much like me. I don't really need to hear, I mean, I don't get that much from hearing someone who does imitation of my music. I don't learn anything from it, and I don't find out anything. But when I hear someone like, there are two composers that are very different, but someone like Glenn Branca, who does an amplified music, which is much louder than my music, and in a certain general way, you can say that it grew out of the kind of climate that was created by myself and a lot of other people, but it doesn't sound like my music.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that very interesting. John Adams on the West Coast, who is closer in certain ways to the early minimal composers in a certain way, has developed a very strong voice of his own, very recognizable style of his own. And I much prefer hearing music by those two men. Someone like Laurie Anderson, who is even much more of a performing artist and involved with pop music. I've known Laurie for a long time. And we lived in really the same community of people in New York. That kind of exchange that goes on among artists is a very normal thing, a very natural thing. And it works both ways, of course. I may influence them, but their music can feed my ideas, too. And I think that a really vital and strong art community, whether it's a music community or a community of visual artists, that kind of exchange is a terrifically accelerating thing for artists. And the people that are involved in it rarely think about, oh, this guy ripped me off or that guy ripped me off. You're working in a climate of creativity where people are really feeding each other. For the most part, it's a very positive thing.
Do you walk around with music in your head most of the time?
Yes. The reason I'm laughing is that my family complains all the time.
That you're distracted?
Well, they say they know. They think I'm in music land. That's what they call it. And it's true. And it's something I can't help doing. I mean, if I'm working, I spend all day, and I just spent the other day doing a work tape of Act Two of a new opera. I'm preparing to send it to the director and the lighting designer so they can begin their work on it. We make work tapes now so they can work with. A lot of designers and directors don't read music, so that's a good way for them to work. And if I come home after 8 hours of doing that, I can't really turn it off. And I'll just be sitting there listening, thinking about things I might change. And my family complains about it a little bit. But they're used to it, and they kind of forgive me, I think. I think that tends to happen when I'm very involved in a current project, which is almost all the time.
Do you ever want to find a way to let it out so that it's not in your head?
Sometimes I'd like to turn it off, to tell you the truth, and there doesn't seem to be any easy way to do that.
Is it as complicated what you carry around as the scores that you write?
It's not that complicated.
I mean, do you in your mind hear all the layers and contrasts?
Yeah, hopefully I do. My music tends to be very clear, and one of the things about starting from a very reductive point, as I did, is that as I added material to it, I tended to add material that I could handle in my own way, so that I don't write music that I can't hear. That's just a preface. I mean, there's some composers that do, and it's just a different way of working. Some of the music's wonderful. It's quite amazing. Some of this music that people, you know that it's very, very hard. I was looking at a string quartet by one of the elder statesmen of the new music world, and I couldn't imagine how he could hear it, and yet I know the piece sounds wonderful. And it's just a different way of working. I tend to work, and I think that partly one of the things that working with Persichetti and Juilliard and then Boulanger in Paris, both of those were very practical musicians who insisted and believed that the music should be something that was very tangible, very real to the composer. And I kind of grew up with those kind of people, with those ideas, and I guess that's become partly the way I work. It doesn't seem that complicated to me, and I think even Einstein, if you listen to it a lot, I mean, you'll find that it's, even as the music has gotten denser, I think it's still fairly clear.
Let's listen to the closing passage of Einstein on the Beach, and this is one of the knee plays. Do you want to discuss a little bit what's happening in the passage we're about to hear?
This is at the very end of the opera, after the apocalyptic spaceship scene. And what's happening, there are two people sitting on a bench, two lovers sitting on a bench, and a man named Mr. Johnson is reading a speech, his that he wrote, by the way. There's a chorus singing one of the main themes from Einstein in using numbers as a text. And the violinist is Paul Zukovsky playing another theme from another part of the opera. So it's a kind of a closing moment. We need a little epilogue. When we finished when I finished writing the spaceship music, which is like a finale, Bob Wilson, who was my collaborator with Einstein, we both thought that we didn't want to end the opera quite so big because it was about a 4.5 or 5 hour opera, and we felt that we wanted to end with something a little quieter, something that you could walk out of the theater was something in your head that was a little more, had a little more repose to it. So this was the ending piece of Einstein on the Beach.
Why did you want to use numbers as the text?
One of the reasons I did it was that the numbers reflect the rhythmic structure of the music for one thing. And I wanted to find a way of using sounds that were also part of the structure of the music and that were things that people were very familiar with and that you had no trouble understanding. So I either use numbers or I use solfège syllables like do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, si. I did not set any vocal text apart from those two things in the opera.
Okay, so this is the closing passage of Einstein on the Beach with music composed by my guest Philip Glass.
Finally, she spoke. know I love you, darling, he replied. I love you more than tongue can tell. You are the light of my life, my sun, moon, and stars. You are my everything. Without you, I have no reason for being. Again, there was silence as the two lovers sat on a park bench, their bodies touching, holding hands in the moonlight. Once more she spoke. How much do you love me, John? She asked. He answered. How much do I love you? Count the stars in the sky. Measure the waters of the oceans with a teaspoon. Number the grains of sand on the seashore. Impossible, you say?
The closing passage of Einstein on the Beach, which was an opera written in collaboration by Philip Glass, who wrote the music, and Robert Wilson, who did the theater part. I don't know how to put that exactly.
Well, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, the theater part. That's a good part. He'd like that.
He'd like that. Okay. Philip Glass is my guest, if you're just joining us. I don't know. It's funny. Like, your operas aren't exactly narrative. I haven't seen one. I've seen you perform. I've seen your ensemble, mm-hmm. but I haven't seen any of the operas, though. I believe they're probably pretty non-narrative, yet they're all rooted in some person, real person from history, Freud, Einstein,
Stalin. Well, of course,
Stalin.
Using... Stalin was Bob's, it wasn't mine.
Oh.
I've used... Well, Einstein, Gandhi, and the new one, Akhenaten, the 18th dynasty pharaoh.
Muybridge?
Muybridge also. It's one way of... The operas are... Up till now, the operas have been really like portraits of people. And the... plot as such is not so important. The idea with Einstein on the Beach, it was a very subjective portrait of Einstein. There was very little attempt to contain any biographical data at all. With Satyagraha, it was about a period of his life in South Africa, and there are events portrayed, but the intention of the opera is to portray Gandhi rather than the events so much. And that's somewhat true of Akhenaten, too. We were talking... about a narrative approach. And in music, in a very simple way, to say it very simply, by taking theme and development and recapitulation out of the music, and that's the most familiar device in classical Western music. What I've done is I've substituted repetitive structures. Often the same basic material will be there throughout a piece. And what happens is it slowly changes throughout the piece. So it's a very different process. And for people who hear it for the first time, it's not so true anymore. But 10 years ago, people couldn't perceive the differences from one moment of the music to the other. And it's almost like when people looked at Pollock and... all they saw were squiggles, and they couldn't see the shape and the form of it. Or even that may have been true of Impressionist painting too, when people looked at the water lilies of Monet, and they actually couldn't see where the water lilies were. You know, so it's partly that our perceptions as viewers and listeners does change, and we learn to perceive things which at first they aren't part of the it's a kind of a habit of listening and viewing. It's the way we're taught to look and listen to things. That obviously can change, and it does change radically from time to time. With this kind of music, which is built really on repetitive structures, there was a big wrench for people about 10 years ago to be able to hear music that focused on such a narrow range of material. That's not so true anymore. I hear that less from people, much, much less than I used to 10 years ago. The idea of a music built out of repetitive structures is something that's now part of the music of our time, and it's been accepted that way, and it's not even attributed to one person anymore. It's a rather large group of people creating a rather large body of work, some of it very, very different.
You had mentioned Pollock, and well, Pollock and composers like Cage, although what they were doing is completely different, have really like got out of structure and used other things to free.
Well, I don't think that's very fair to say about Cage.
About Cage, because he was creating structures, but it was through chance processes. But
yeah.
But you've created a very tight set of structures. Did you feel like a need? Do you like structured music? Or
evidently. Cage is an interesting person. He had a tremendous impact on me, first in terms of his writing. And not only myself, but almost every younger artist and composer, very few escape the influence of Cage. Though certainly my work doesn't sound like Cage.
Sure doesn't.
But what he did is he gave us permission, in a way, to create things that were unfamiliar. And he had the courage to live a life as an active performing musician, which, again, that's one of the things about Cage that you have to remember, that his associated with the Cunningham Dance Company, he is a composer performer and is to the present. I just was on a program with him. It was a benefit concert for The Kitchen, which is a performance space in New York, and the guy's still performing, and he will, I'm sure he'll go on for his whole life. But the idea that that you could work as a performing musician, that a composer can make his way in the world as a performer, was something which he was one of the rare few people that did that. And he was very inspiring to people. I think that in a way where I once told him, I said that I was one of his children, whether he liked it or not.
Do you know what he thinks of your music?
Oh, I think he does like Satya Graha. He told me that. Some of the other music he hasn't liked so well, I don't think. I think that John has always been more interested in people that follow the tradition that he has created, though he's extremely open about other people's work. My music isn't close to him, though I have felt close to him in certain ways, and I've told him that, and I think he's had to accept that.
Are your musical interests as diverse as the music as the people who listen to you and who have been influenced by you?
I think so. I listen to the radio a lot myself, just because of the variety of music. That what I can hear on the radio is much a bigger range than any cassette collection or record collection that I may have, especially for hearing new music, which that's been one of the important things about not only the NPR radio system, but the college radios, and which are also, some of them are tied in, or the kind of not-for-profit independent stations that you find, that's where you can hear a lot of experimental music or new music, whether it's jazz or new music or recordings of old recordings of Caruso or any kind of odd thing that you might, as well as hearing new performances of Bartok by the Jolera Quartet, any of those things. I'm liable to listen to anything. I have two teenage kids who listen to a radio station in New York, which is mostly new wave, so I keep up with that too. We have very different ideas about what's good and what isn't in that genre. They tend to think that anybody that I know isn't interesting because they're someone that I know.
It's funny, you think that kind of thing wouldn't happen when your father's Philip Glass.
Oh, it happens. It really happens. As soon as they find out it's somebody that I know, then they start to lose interest in them. It's interesting to... I've been very interested in the new wave music because I think that for many people, for many young people, that's become a new kind of art music. I think we have to remember that this is a lot of this is not commercial music. That we've always associated popular music and commercial music as being the same. This isn't true anymore. There's a whole category of popular music that is not commercial. There are guys that are not making a lot of money, that are just getting along and taking chances with their work and inventing new ways of working, that are very much, they're operating very much as committed, dedicated people. And I think you no longer can, someone working in popular music, you can't dismiss them as not being serious at all.
You were a prodigy. Was there pressure on you to perform?
Oh, no, not really. And was I a prodigy? I don't really know. I mean, as a young person, I began performing when I was about 10. And I was played actively pretty much until I was about 15. During the period of my initial studies in music, at Juilliard, I was really concentrating on writing. And the trouble with Juilliard is that there were so many good players there. So I had begun as a flutist. If I wrote a flute piece, I could get Paula Robeson to play it. So how could I play it, you see? I mean, that was the kind of thing that went on there, so that we were, most of us, that's not all of us, because Paul Sikorsky also used to, he associated himself with the composers at Juilliard, though he mostly was a performer. But most of us found the kind of performing skills that were around us a little intimidating, and it took me quite a few years till I could get back to performing. I didn't actually begin performing again until I was around 28. So it was a period of more than 10 years where I really wasn't performing that much.
Are there things that you feel the musical aspect of your life separated you from other people your age, things that you couldn't do because you were studying?
No, because I just didn't do that. I learned to be a pretty good pool player, and I learned to drive a motorcycle, and I did everything else, the things that everybody else did. That didn't happen to me. I've always had a lot of general interests, and always, especially in America, America as a country, America as in the different parts. I've traveled around the country a lot. I've lived in different parts of the country. I've had a lot of different kinds of jobs experience, and also in the process of becoming an independent composer, a freelance composer, if you want to call it, I worked a lot. I had a lot of different jobs, and so that put me into a lot of odd situations, or not odd, I mean odd for a composer, but not for someone who's making a living in America.
Well, up until 5 years ago, you were holding other jobs, such as being a cab driver to support yourself.
Yeah, I did more things than that. I did all kinds of things. I had a moving company. I worked for a plumber for a while. I worked as a studio assistant for an artist. I did a lot of different things.
Is it a relief to not have to do that now?
I wonder. Sometimes I miss it.
Really?
For example, moving furniture is that there's nothing to think about when you're moving furniture. And I used to think about music a lot. I have more time for my music now, but a lot of that time is eaten up by things that I'm doing today, for example, which I actually enjoy doing it. But you can spend a lot of time not actually writing music, but involved with the business of music, and not the music writing part of music.
Do things come to you as you're physically engaged in something else, but your mind is free? Is that a good time to think?
For me, that happens, I try to keep my work times fairly regular, but that isn't always possible.
Can we discuss the direction your music is moving in now?
Well, what I've been doing, the new record that I think you began the program with, is a piece called The Photographer. It's a theater piece, music theater piece. And I think since Einstein on the Beach, I've become increasingly involved with big theater pieces, whether some of them are actually full-scale operas, like Akhenaten is a commission for the Stuttgart Opera. It'll also be built in America at the Houston Opera. There are things like that fall more into the traditional idea of what an opera is, mostly in terms of the forces involved, a chorus, soloist, orchestra. Then there are a whole range of theater pieces, music theater pieces, which are kind of in some kind of in-between place, like The Photographer, where you have some staging, some singing, but they're not integrated in an operatic way. I've become more and more interested in theater, but I think... I said earlier in the program that one of the first pieces I did was for a theater. I worked with the Bamboo Vines for many years, writing incidental music for them. The difference has been that what's happened over the years is I've become more the determinating factor in the projects. Like when I do an opera now, I pick the subject and I pick the designer and the people I want to work with in terms of libretto and so forth. When I was working for the Mabut Mines, which I still do, they'll give me a play and say, we need music here, here, and here, and that becomes incidental music. And that's not... I still do that, but my main interest now is involving myself as an author in a general concept of the piece, in the choice of subject, the choice of design, the choice of... I don't do the design, I work closely with all those people.
I've had the impression, just listening to your last couple of albums, and I don't know if this is completely off track or not, that your music is maybe getting more emotional.
I think that's true, and I think it has to do with working directly in theater. And I think that for me, that has been the most attractive place to work in, and it's been a place that I could continue to grow in. The ensemble still exists. We still travel. But now what I'm doing is I'm adapting theater pieces for a performance. that's changed the content of the concerts to a certain extent. Though the kind of things that happen on this program happens often in concerts. I tend to play a big range of music, music from 1969 to the present. I like the idea of the diversity of the music being presented as part of a program.
Also, I get the feeling that after building a really complex system that you're now paring it down a little bit.
In terms of the music?
Yeah.
That sounds true. Individual pieces can be misleading. That seems to be true of the photographer, but Akhenaten is one of the densest, more complex pieces I've done, and I've done it just very recently. I'm still working on the third act, as a matter of fact. So one of the ways I work, I tend not to follow one pattern too long, so that I like the juxtaposition. For example, also while I was writing Akhenaten, I wrote a string quartet for the Mabu Mines for a production of a Becker production they did, and it's a very lyrical, light piece of music. At the same time that I was writing this very heavy opera about this 18th dynasty pharaoh, I'd like that kind of diversity in my own work process. It's something that keeps me. It seems to me it keeps me alive in terms of my own work.
Well, I've really enjoyed meeting with you and talking with you, and I greatly enjoy your music, and it's really glad you're able to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
We're going to hear the solo opening from Glassworks. Would you like to just say a couple of words about that before we
One of the things that was interesting me about doing this is that I play the piano a lot myself, acoustic piano at home. And, of course, no one ever gets to hear that because I'm always playing with the ensemble. And I decided on this record that I would start off this composition with a solo piano piece. And it's something that I was very familiar with, but very few other people have gotten to hear it. I guess that was the main thing. When I first delivered the tape to the CBS who produced it, they were a little worried that no one would recognize it as being my piece because no one had heard just piano music, but it turned out to be an ill-founded fear, I think.
Absolutely. Let's hear it.